We feel that it's a parallel to our own larger American history. That is to say, that the national parks are the Declaration of Independence applied to the landscape. And just as the Declaration of Independence is a complex, sort of vague document that says all men are created equal, Thomas Jefferson meant all white men of property, free of debt. We mean something else by all men are created equal. Now it means all men of all color, women. We protect our young, our elderly, the handicapped. We debate the unborn and those of different sexual preference. And so the story of America could be said to be the continual expansion of that idea, at that time relatively limited idea. So too the national parks have grown. And I think it's just a really wonderful, spectacular way to understand ourselves. This is not just a travelogue or a nature film. It's the history of the people. And more often than not, though, what comes to mind are the Theodore Roosevelts and the John D. Rockefeller Jr.'s and the John Muir, famous white men from on high, benevolently bestowing us with these parks. It is, in fact, a much more diverse story of black and brown and red and yellow and female and unknown, ordinary people, so-called ordinary people, at each place falling in love with it and insisting on it being saved. And so the arc of our story is incredibly diverse and complicated, and in the end, I think, very powerful and inspirational one.
And how did you decide which parks to include?
Well, it's, you know, you don't want to be an encyclopedia or a phone book. So it's pretty easy. You want to tell a narrative. It begins in Yosemite when the first land was set aside but given to the state of California for its care. It jumps to Yellowstone, which, because it was Wyoming territory and there was no entity to give it to, became a national park. And then how it grew. And you return again to Yosemite and Yellowstone and the Grand Canyon and Denali, an early and important park and symbolic of so many of the trends and tendencies in the history of the national parks.
How much time did you spend in Alaska, and which parks did you visit?
We visited all the 58 natural national parks and therefore all the parks in Alaska. We spent a lot of time in Denali and Kenai Fjords, and we had crews in all the other parks, Glacier Bay and Kobuk and Lake Clark and Gates of the Arctic and Wrangell St. Elias and Katmai and have I forgotten one? of the national parks, and we have spectacular footage. I mean, it's, you have to be an idiot to not point your camera in Alaska and not hit the jackpot.
And how about Alaska characters? Who are the main Alaskan characters that you highlight in the film?
Well, you know, we focus to help tell our story specifically on Adolf Murray, who was a biologist from Minnesota who came up here very early and fell in love with McKinley Denali and spent a long time studying the wolves being the sort of crux of, are you going to really live out the true meaning of your creed, as Dr. King said? That is to say, really save these places? What are you going to do with the most hated predator of all time? And the wolf becomes the symbol of so much of the tensions in Alaska, besides the question of who owns the land, can the federal government determine, et cetera, et cetera. He's an important character. And then it's just the huge battle taking place in lots of different parts of the state. It's really the character, the main character of this film is the place. So I'd have to say the principal character in Alaska is Denali, the high one.
And what would you say the biggest challenges were for filming here?
You know, it's funny. The word challenge has an essential pejorative aspect to it, and yet for us the challenge is why you do it. The challenge is having to film in extraordinary circumstances and getting up early. I mean, when you're a filmmaker shooting The Dawn and the Dusk, Alaska provides some real problems because that's often a 22 or 23-hour window to be up and at it. But it was more the fact that it is so spectacularly beautiful. It was the improvisation and the adjustments that you make to go into some place and figure out how to bring it back. For us, the crux is story. It's how do you tell a good story? You can collect all the beautiful images in the world. You can find all the old archival photographs. You can do interviews with people who are incredibly compelling. But unless you find a way to stitch them together, to interweave, in the case of this series, more than 50 people will introduce to you, not just John Muir and Teddy Roosevelt, that becomes a very complicated dynamic. So we repair to our editing house in New Hampshire and spend years trying to sort of use the footage in the best way in the service of this complicated and utterly American story.
You mentioned Dinelli in particular. Did you, both in Alaska and in other parts of the country, did you find time or take time, or was it part of the idea to take time to talk with some of the indigenous people of the area in Alaska, the Athabascan people that have stories about Dinelli? Did you have any time to include that in this look at the parks?
Well, yes and no. No, in that we didn't speak to a native person in Alaska about it, but we made a conscious effort in every single national park to remind people that this is not a white European story, that it is an ancient geological story, and it is a story of native peoples that didn't have to have their land discovered by white people. It was already there. And our Native American interpreter, if you will, is Gerard Baker, who's a Mandan Hidatsa Indian from North Dakota and now presently the superintendent of Mount Rushmore. Those statues of those faces of four presidents carved into the sacred land of many Indian tribes in the Black Hills. The irony is not lost, I don't think, in the film. But from the very moment that our series begins in 1851, when the Mariposa Battalion goes into this beautiful valley to exterminate, to dispossess the Awanichi Indians of their homelands for hundreds of generations, to the Alaska Acts, in which for the first time Native peoples, the Athabascans and the Inupiats and the Inuits and the Aleuts and the Tlingits, are all included in the story of the national parks. We've honored the presence of Native peoples, and often our music is very much a part of that.
The last installment tells the story of the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act, ANILCA. How tricky was it to tell what is a very complicated story?
It is a very complicated story, and those people who are familiar with the intricacies will undoubtedly find that in our last episode, episode 6, of which the Alaska story is the last main chapter of our series, that it is an abbreviated, but it's a fantastic story and filled with very familiar tensions and conflicts that have been there since the very beginning, and filled with the kind of conflict that makes for a good story. And so to us, it's a wonderful and instructive chapter. It has that echo of all the other places where land was set aside and there was a great deal of local hue and cry, and then a kind of acquiescence, and then not only an acceptance, but an embracing of it. That is throughout our series the case. Arizona went crazy when the Grand Canyon was set aside. It's now on their license plate. Wyoming went crazy when the land in front of the Teton Mountains was added to Teton National Park. It's now on their license plate. The town of Seward passed two resolutions condemning the creation of Kenai Fjords Monument and later National Park, and have rescinded those resolutions and now asked the federal government to expand the park. This is what you find, that there's often that sense of local resistance. Why don't we have a better sense of what we need, forgetting that there's often superseding national interests? We don't argue about the presence of an Air Force base, understanding there's a superseding national interest. Is it possible for us to expand our consciousness to understand that saving these precious places, which might be the last refuge for endangered species, or the last refuge for us human beings needing a glimpse of primeval America, could be just as important as the other things that we understand could be superseding national federal interests?
In your travels around the country and dealing with these issues of setting aside land, how do you think that the story of ANILCA is one that many Americans, did you get a sense of how familiar people were with this story, or do people understand it?
People don't know anything about the history of the national parks. They go in with basic assumptions. They've always been there. Of course, they haven't. They always will be there. They won't, unless we continue to be active participants Tory stewards. I mean, it's like liberty itself requiring that eternal vigilance to make sure that we haven't eroded the freedoms of this republic. And I think that they've always assumed that the Park Service was there, and it hasn't. The Park Service shows up halfway through our third of six episodes, which begs the questions, who's taking care of the parks? Well, we've got some interesting story to tell you, not the least of which is the story in Yosemite and Sequoia that the African-American buffalo soldiers in the first decade of the 20th century were the protectors of the parks. So you have a decade in which more African-Americans are being lynched than in any other decade in our history, telling people, white people, what they could and could not do in a national park. And that, as one ranger says in our film, is the beginning of a very interesting day. So what we're trying to do is acknowledge the fact that most people have no idea. And Anilka is as ancient history as, you know, the creation of Yosemite in the 1860s.
How do you think U.S. history would have been altered without national parks?
Well, it was funny. I was talking with a group of students this morning, and I asked them if they'd seen It's a Wonderful Life, Jimmy Stewart movie, and three out of the four had. The difference of the United States with or without the parks is the difference between Bedford Falls and Pottersville. We would be bereft of one of the great legacies that we've not only given to ourselves but to the rest of the world. Our idea has been copied, like the idea of freedom, and exported around the world. There are more than 200 countries with well more than 4,000 units of national park land across this globe, and it was born in this country out of a purely democratic interest. I think if we didn't have national parks or they were to disappear, we would disappear. We would not be the country that we would hope we would be. We would not be a free and democratic party, a democratic country, because we would see that the people who had taken it away had done it because there was, you know, some industrial interest or some reason for rich fans to get still richer. And we would lose the patrimony that is the heritage of these national parks.
Your last big project, The War, was criticized for not including stories of Hispanics or Native Americans in the original version. Did that episode change the way that you approached this project?
Not at all. We began this project well before that one. And in fact, it was in many ways a specious criticism because there are 1,000 movies on the Second World War, and we had decided to do it entirely different by randomly picking four geographically distributed towns. And we're not interested in different ethnic – we had no German Americans, much bigger or no Irish Americans, much bigger ethnic groups. We didn't have any French Americans. We didn't have lots of different groups. We were picking people with combat experience. And any soldier, including the Hispanics, who wrote us in absolute horror and shock and apology that we were subjected to that kind of criticism, said that when I put on the uniform of the United States, I was not a Hispanic American. I was an American. And we spoke to many Hispanics who did not want to be interviewed. They said that the real heroes were their friends they'd left on the battlefield. And so we proceeded until the controversy arose as if we were doing some grand encyclopedic thing. If we'd done something like that, we would have included everyone. But we'd already had scripts for the national parks in which it's in some ways the most diverse film we've done, and naturally occurring not in any politically correct impulse, but the story of the national parks is a bottom-up story. If you lift the rock of any park, there's an individual or a group of people that fell in love with this place and spent their whole lives trying to save it for you and me, people they would never meet. And those people are, as I said, you know, from every conceivable background.
So what's on the horizon for you for next projects? This is a six-part series, and as you're well aware, with the economy and our industry as a whole, there's a lot of trouble out there.
Yeah.
And I wonder about the future of being able to do a full examination such as a six-part series. Does it look like this type of rich work will be able to continue in the future?
It has to continue. I don't think you have an option. And public broadcasting has a future. We have an unassailable brand. And I think that these are tough times, and a lot of stations have had to cut back, and it's been very painful for people. And the fundraising environment is horrific out there and incredibly difficult. But what is the alternative? We have 500 stations and nothing on. And yet this underfunded entity called public television still continues to produce the best science, the best nature, the best public affairs, the best arts, the best, you know, public performance, the best history, the best children's. I mean, on the dial. This is a huge legacy, and we're obligated to try to continue it, to offer some alternative to the stultifying pap that is on just about everything else. And so you just redouble your efforts. And yes, we're right now updating our baseball series with what we're calling a 10th inning. We're in the middle of editing that, as well as a 3-part, 6-hour series on the history of Prohibition. We've just begun work, production on a history of the Roosevelts, Theodore Franklin and Eleanor, which will be 5 or 6 episodes, 10 or 12 hours. We're going to do Vietnam. We've got lots of projects in the work. And, you know, we'll get out of this, and it'll be brighter on the other side. And I think if we, the greatest danger is to try to become what we despise, to sort of so transform ourselves in subtle ways into a much more commercial posture that we lose the very essence of what we are. You know, we have one foot tentatively in the marketplace, but the other proudly and defiantly out of it. And that needs to be what we do. And I think we'll be fine. You know, the PBS.org, you know, I think about the intrusions of the internet is one of the most popular sites, .org sites, if not the most popular .org site. We need each other. And there are very few things that remind us why we agree to cohere as a country. All the different stations are going for their different niche or within their programming schedule for to collect a small group of people. And it's only public television that says, you know, is the unum in the pluribus. So that's why I've stayed for 35 years. That's why I will continue to stay, God willing, for another 35 years.